Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating. We really appreciate it. Coming up on this week's programme, we're going to be talking about the fallibility of memory in a really interesting study done by researchers in UCD where they looked at whether or not your memory of a night can be influenced by various factors depending on whether or not you were accused of a sexual assault or you were the victim of that assault. Really, really interesting research. If you'd like to get in touch with the podcast, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter. We're at Newstalk Science as well. First, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news. We're joined by Dr. Laura Dungan, immunologist, and Dr. Tara Shine of Change by Degrees. You're both very welcome. Our first story, Laura, is about ultra-processed foods.
Yeah, so the American Heart Association have issued what they call a scientific advisory, and they issue a few of these every year. There's no sort of exact schedule, but if there's new and good research about something, say hypertension, obesity, something along those lines, they'll issue a really well thought out, peer reviewed scientific advisory. And that's what they've done for the first time ever about ultra processed foods. Now, this is kind of a catch-all term that I personally don't love, but it means foods that have been essentially gone through a huge amount of processing to create them. So they have a lot of ingredients like refined sugars, oils, additives, emulsifiers, colors, preservatives, all of these things. And the American Heart Association has come out and said that these are, surprise, surprise, not good for you. But what they have not really outlined is exactly why. And what they have said is the key reason why they're not good for you is because the ingredients in them contain saturated fats, sugars, and sodium. And to me, this is not the world's greatest shock, because we do know that high salt, high sugar, and high fat foods are not good for you. Now, I wanted to really read around this, because what they have said is there is no evidence thus far that the processing or the fact that they are quote unquote ultra processed is the problem more than the ingredients, but they are saying that more research is needed. So what they're suggesting is that, yes, we know the ingredients are bad, but if you took the same ingredients and you didn't ultra process them, would they be better for you? So is the processing itself, whatever has to happen to process it, or the additives, the emulsifiers, the things that go into it, are they the problem? And what they have said is there's actually no real evidence yet, but they do recommend that more research is done. I suppose when vapes first came out, nobody thought that they were great. Nobody was like, oh, vapes are clearly going to be brilliant. So they're suggesting that a lot more research has to be done. Now, not all ultra-processed foods are created equally. So for instance, if you had an ultra-processed whole grain breakfast cereal, I personally, as a doctor and a mother, would recommend you give that rather than a stick of purified butter to your children for breakfast, because butter is not ultra processed, but it's not going to be great for you. But what they are saying is that these are definitely considered to be more addictive. So there is research that shows that they don't give you the same satiety or sense of satisfaction and fullness after eating them that other foods that are not ultra processed might. So people tend to go back for more. They do increase obesity rates. And there is a massive social divergence in this. There are people from lower income backgrounds who can only afford ultra-processed foods. And there is a huge amount of unfairness potentially in the system at the moment. So it is a warning that is saying a lot more research is needed. We know that high sugar, high fat, and high salt is bad. That's not news. But we want to find out whether the processing itself is the issue. But overarchingly, they are saying aim to avoid ultra-processed foods wherever possible. That's easy for wealthier people, not so easy for people who can't afford food.
But as you say, it's a very grey label, and it's not, you know, it's not something that you stick on any food at the moment, like breakfast cereals, you know, even wholemeal bread or yogurt or margarines, plant milks like almond milk. These would be considered to be ultra processed in some definitions. And at the same time, clearly much better for you than, you know, a packet of crisps or whatever that have been reconstituted to make a particular shape and made in their billions. Like, to me, it's really not helpful not to have this understanding of what exactly ultra processed is. And if we look at, you know, the work that's been done on this, there has been a reasonable amount of work looking at this food, has there not? I mean, like,
there has.
We do know that it's not good for us typically to have food that doesn't come from ingredients that you have. You know, obviously much better to home cook, right? We do know that, do we?
We do. And look, I couldn't agree more. I find it a really frustrating term and it's bandied about an awful lot. And people say, don't eat UPFs, don't eat ultra processed foods. But what does that mean? What you really need is to understand the nutritional content of your food, in my opinion. So like I said, a stick of butter that's come directly from a cow, you don't just sit there and munch on that. But if you were to have a whole grain cereal or soy milk or something along those lines, it is not going to be the same issue. So what we need is a key understanding of the nutritional benefits of different nutrients. And yes, of course, home-cooked meals from pure ingredients are going to be better. Not all can afford, but yeah, correct. It's a term that's bandied about and I find frustrating.
And now for something completely different, Tara, a nuclear reactor on the moon.
Given all the trials and tribulations we have here on Earth, of course, you would think this would be the most important thing in the world, which is NASA now declaring that they would like to build a nuclear reactor on the moon by 2030 so that we can have human life in a number of settlements on the moon. So I don't know if that feels very mission critical at the moment, given the state of the world, but this is also part of a kind of a new international space race with China and Russia to try and see who can set up settlements on the moon first. So it's not a new announcement, but they've pushed the date forward. China and Russia say they'll have their nuclear stations built up there by 2035. The US now, for some reason, says no, they're going to do it by 2030. They have a new chief appointed by Trump, this guy called Sean Duffy, who says this is because they're afraid that China and Russia will declare kind of keep out zones and I guess colonialize parts of the moon, and they want to get up there and establish their claims as well. So not sure this is all motivated by the best intentions.
No. And at the same time, you know, you have to put money aside for scientific exploration. You know, it seems that we have decided as a community and society that we're not going to put all of our money into just solving cancer. And I think I kind of understand why we don't do that. At the same time, I suppose a nuclear reactor on the moon does give opportunities for research, for further scientific endeavors there. I mean, having an endless energy supply on the moon would reduce a huge amount of effort in terms of setting things up over there, right? Have they said anything about how they're going to do this?
Yeah, so I mean, the first thing I guess is like, why nuclear? So it's nuclear because solar power is unreliable on the moon, because its days and nights don't work like days and nights on Earth. There's 2 weeks of sunlight and then 2 weeks of darkness. So yeah, you can
and
get
batteries. Batteries just wouldn't be suitable for that environment.
Well, they're saying batteries wouldn't be suitable. But they need to look at batteries and solar differently.
Yeah.
So most of the experts say, look, some kind of nuclear energy up there is inevitable. If there's going to be lunar habitation. So if we're actually going to have people able to go and stay on the moon for periods of time. And the actual size of the nuclear reactor they're trying to build is pretty tiny. But obviously they have to get all the materials up there. So launching radioactive material through space to the moon, that presents certain kind of challenges and risks. So they need to look at that. At the moment, there's also questions and a lot of controversy around the ability of the US and others to actually be regularly able to get people to and from the moon. So
yeah.
Are we solving the problem before we need to is another question. But there seems to be this sort of inevitability around the fact that there will be nuclear energy on the moon, less certainty about what kind of point in time you have this regular movement to and fro from the moon in terms of the human beings that would be up there then in these settlements. And then massive questions. I mean, it's no different to looking at something like the continent of Antarctica, but around sovereignty, resource use and control, who owns what, something that belongs to none of humanity or all of humanity. How do some countries go up there and claim a stake over this resource? And loads of ethical questions there.
For sure. I think the general, you know, hippie space vibes, you know, post Cold War have sort of dissipated quite a lot. I think, the idea that America and Russians and Europe would all work together towards a common goal in space, I think that's really on much more shakier ground than it ever has been. So, I do think it will get more territorial. But I suppose, you know, looking at the most positive version of this, could this nuclear reactor on the moon get people inspired to think about perhaps nuclear being a very good idea back here on Earth? I mean, I don't know how you feel about it, Tara, but I feel like nuclear was the biggest chance our planet ever had, and we seem to have just passed it by.
I mean, I think anything that opens up conversations around our energy choices is really important. I mean, can you also argue for the cost that it's going to take to do this? Maybe we couldn't take that same amount of investment and invest it in actually, you know, solving some of the blockages that are to scaling up, you know, all the kind of energy solutions, even renewable energy solutions here on Earth. Because obviously everything costs so much more when you're doing it in space. But it does, you know, it does open the conversation around what are our choices around spending money, particularly for NASA, because NASA they're facing a minimum of 24% budget cuts in 2026, right at the time where they're given this task to do. So what they're going to chop in order to do this would be really interesting to see as well. So yeah. And it's interesting having these like new kind of scientific goals set out there at a time where right across this sector, there's massive, massive cuts.
Yeah, but this like, as opposed to, you know, exploring the moons of Jupiter, this sort of, you know, putting a nuclear reactor on the moon feels very Trumpian. It feels like the sort of thing that would get past Trump. Our third story has to do with the chikungunya virus in China. Lara, what is this and why is there concern in China?
Yeah, so there's been a big outbreak of this chikungunya virus. There's about 8,000 cases now reported in the Guangdong province in China. And the reason it's a concern is because it can have quite severe symptoms. More often than not, it doesn't. But it is a virus that is transmitted by mosquito bite. So just like malaria, for instance, or dengue fever, a mosquito that has been infected from drinking blood from someone who is infected bites you, you get the virus. You will get very high fevers maybe 3 to 7 days later, get nausea, headaches, rash, quite severe joint pain, which more often than not resolves in a week or two on its own. In some more severe cases, the joint pain can last for months or even years. But that tends to be in people who already had pre-existing joint pain. It tends not to kill people as a general rule. I mean, obviously very young babies, very elderly people are much more vulnerable, but less than 1 in 1,000 people will die from this virus. And it cannot be transmitted from person to person under normal circumstances, I should say. But what's happening in China is a viral video went out and about 90 million people have viewed it now, showing health authorities entering a home at 1:30 in the morning where a teenage daughter was minding her younger brother who had been to a pharmacy that day because he had a fever. The pharmacy had been forced legally to report this child with the fever because he had bought medication to target a fever. And the mother, who was a single parent who was out working in a restaurant at the time, came home to find the authorities effectively in her house, forcibly taking blood from her two children. So it was pretty distressing. And they have the legal right to do this. Laws that were enforced during COVID allow them to enter houses and to do this. To me, it seems insane. There was absolutely no reason to do it at 1:30 in the morning. These children cannot, even if they had it, spread it to each other or to anyone else. They are not mosquitoes. They are not biting people. It is insanity in my mind. But this is what has sparked this massive debate. Now, they are doing sensible things as well, where they are removing places where mosquitoes will breed. They are doing important and useful public health measures. But the chikungunya virus has been around for, I mean, I obviously don't know how long it's been around, but it was discovered in the 1950s in Africa. There are outbreaks all the time in Africa, Asia. This isn't something that people have massively concerned themselves about before. So it is a very unusual reaction to what was a pretty benign situation of a child with a fever. So just to be clear, obviously in Ireland and countries in Europe, this cannot happen. We are okay here. But it is kind of a crazy reaction to a fairly benign situation. Not benign if you have it, but it is unusual, I would say, to go to these measures.
Be really interesting to see the decision sequence that led to that forcible entry of the home. Because when you think about it, if the intention was to contain the virus or help you know, epidemiologically, you know, make sure that the country was more safe, you know, creating an event that goes viral, that gets people worried, that I'm sure is lighting up the servers of, you know, conspiracy theorists all over the world right now. It just seems like a crazy thing to do so thoughtlessly, considering that we're now talking about it in an Irish radio program.
Yes, agreed.
Our final story is an interesting one. So this isn't a new story, right? And we usually typically talk about stories that happened last week, but this is not in the last week. But the reaction to it is, this is about a Danish zoo tower that made a very unusual plea to the public.
Yeah, and it was a reminder plea. It wasn't actually even a new request, but it reminded the public of a program that it's had for a long time that allows you to donate your pet, your, I don't know, unwanted pet, your pet that might otherwise have to be put down for some reason, to them to be euthanized by the zoo and fed to their carnivores. And this has created massive controversy because they're like, is this right or wrong for pets to be fed to the carnivores, those lions, tigers, cheetahs that are in the zoo? People have reacted badly to this reminder. It has caused all kinds of problems for the zoo in terms of the ethics of this and that it's wrong. And the zoo has had to take down some of its social media feeds because there has been such a backlash and such a negative reaction to this. The zoo is saying, well, we're just trying to mimic the natural food chain. They need to feed whole carcasses, ideally, to these types of carnivores. Those carnivores need to chew through bone, tissue, cartilage, hair and fur in order to be healthy, and that this is just one way that they do this. But yeah, they're getting a massive, massive reaction. Something in this is about the use of the word pet, I think, and the fact that people are like, oh my goodness, we're feeding our pets to the zoo animals. But in some of the feedback that comes through in some of the articles, it also shows how unaware people are about what animals in zoos are fed, and the fact that, you know, carnivores have to eat meat and that meat has to come from somewhere. And quite often it's goats, cows, sheep, horses, lots and lots of horses get fed to animals in zoos. But I guess it's just not talked about. It's not seen. And so when it's made public like this, it causes people to kind of wake up and think about it.
Yeah, it's kind of the same sort of thing as how we eat meat. You know, we really don't like to think about the process by which the steak comes to our plate. But I was in Kenya not so long ago doing a documentary about an antelope, and they had some lions, and it was an animal orphanage. They had some lions and some other carnivores there. And as we went down to visit the orphanage to film some footage, we saw this lovely hutch system of rabbits. And we were with a young child, and they were like, oh, look at these rabbits. And we were quickly shooed away from the rabbits. And afterwards, I was asking the guide, I was like, what was the story there? They were like, oh, this is the lion's food. We're about to throw all of these into the lion's pen. And of course, you know, if you're planning on rehabilitating any of these animals, which sometimes does happen in zoos, you do want that, you know, that fight or flight. You want that instinct to hunt and so on to still be there. But like, you know, a blind guinea pig at the end of its life, you know, I'm not sure how much of a test that will give to, you know, to a cougar or, you know, a mountain lion who, you know, needs to stay fresh to make it in the wild. I don't know. It seems like an unusual thing. And also, you know, guinea pigs aren't particularly typical food for a lot of these animals, right?
No, and I mean, in most cases here, it's not about feeding live animals to the zoo animals at all. It's the animals are still dead, right?
Yeah.
So the animals are humanely killed in whatever way. The whole thing is that you feed them a carcass, and that this is what's good for their nutrition, for their muscles. Like, they have to, for their brains, it gives them something to think about. They have to chew. They have to think about what way they go into the carcass. Like, that is the important part. And obviously,
right,
if you're a zoo, you're trying to figure out how to get access to this food for your carnivores. Costs, I imagine, are always issues for zoos. And, you know, there's a really interesting story then back earlier this year where Nuremberg Zoo had too many baboons, right, for its area, and it was becoming inhumane to keep so many baboons in this space that they had. So they needed to cull some of the baboons. So they culled 10 of the baboons, and then rather than waste them, they fed them, once they were dead, to the lions and tigers. And
again, I thought you were going to say back to the baboons. I was like, no. Yeah, that sort of makes sense. You know, like, I do think that any animal that is going to end up in landfill, like that's horrific. Like, you know, if it is appropriate to feed to an animal, but there is something weird about asking us, you know, give us your Friskies and your Rexes and your Freds or your Mrs. Fluffy Pants or whatever you call your animal and saying, well, we've had a great life together, now go get eaten by a lion. But, you know, who am I to judge? Dr. Lara Dungan and Dr. Tara Shine, thank you so much for your time. Just a warning, our next discussion relates to sexual assault crimes and cases. We often think about our memory as being infallible, but what if your memory of an event felt completely real but just wasn't? In courtroom battles that hinge on he said, she said, especially in sexual assault cases, memory can be often the only evidence. Today we're joined by Dr. Kira Green. She's Associate Professor at the School of Psychology at UCD, where she heads up the Attention and Memory Laboratory to explore the science behind memory distortion. Kira, welcome to the program. This is obviously a sensitive subject, but also a really fascinating one from an understanding of how our brain retains and stores memories. Maybe you might start off telling us a little bit about your research and why you were interested in this particular area.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm a memory scientist, really. So my research all really focuses on the ways we kind of encode information and then how we access that information again when we want to remember events from our lives. And I suppose the kind of the key way we would approach this is that many people tend to think of memory as though it's like a computer file, you know, that like the information is just there and the only problem you have is whether or not you can access it. And all you need to do is just, you know, find the right route and the information will be there and you'll be able to access it. But what we know from lots of many, many years of work on this is that that memory actually isn't just stored, it's actually reconstructed. So every time we go to remember something, we're not actually retrieving it, we're actually rebuilding it from the ground up. And one of the ways that we know this is that where there has been a huge amount of research is in the area of eyewitness memory.
Yeah.
So this is, you know, research about somebody is a witness to a crime. And then later, you know, when they're questioned about that, we realize actually their memory of those details might not be totally accurate.
We interviewed Elizabeth Loftus on the program.
Yes, and we've worked with Beth Loftus before.
Yeah. And she and this, you know, this work, you know, was a real eye opener because she was showing that what you think is your memory is really a sort of an assembly that your brain puts together for the purposes of telling a story.
Yeah, exactly. So one way we like to say it is, you know, when you think about accessing a memory, it's not like you're reading a book, it's like you're writing the book. Mm. You know, it's a really, we tend to think of it as being quite a kind of passive process, like you're just, you know, like accessing a memory that's there, but it's really much more active than that. We're actively creating the memory. And a lot of, you know, we use a lot of different cues in our environment. We use our own past experiences, our biases, our preconceptions. We use all of those as like a scaffolding to help us rebuild that memory.
I'm very familiar with this in practice, actually, because I had for about 5 years told the story of being overtaken in the toilet queue by Coolio at a party in California, only to meet up with the friend who I'd been at that party with to be told that was him who'd been overtaken in the Coolio. I had never even met Coolio, which was very disappointing.
Yeah, this is a really, really common thing. And it's, you know, and it's because essentially you have this, you've created this sort of mental image of it. And in that mental image, you've kind of plugged in that it's you in that image instead of your friend, because it's a better story, it fits better, you know.
Yeah,
you know, we never say like never let the truth get in the way of a good story, you know? And our memory is like that to a certain extent.
So that's fine when you're chatting to friends about things that may or may not have happened at parties, but when it comes to more serious things such as crimes and sexual assault cases, obviously what actually happened is of huge importance. Can you talk to me about this particular study and its methodology, please?
Absolutely. So I suppose just to give a bit of background to why we wanted to look at this in the first place. So like I said, there's loads of, you know, work about eyewitness memory and how eyewitnesses' memories can be really flawed. And I mean, we don't want to overdo that because, you know, sometimes you can come to the impression that you can never trust anyone's memory. And that's not the case, you know, but, you know, we do need to be aware of the ways that memories can be fragile. And what will often happen is that if you have, say, a he said, she said type case. So if you have a case of, for example, sexual assault, in which there is no dispute about the fact that sex of some kind took place, what's at issue is whether or not there was consent for the sexual activity. So you'll often have what we call these sort of he said, she said cases, where there are two parties, there's no other witnesses to the incident. There's just two people who maybe after a party, you know, some sexual activity happened. And then one person later says, I didn't consent to that. And because there are no other witnesses, because, you know, nobody disputes that sexual activity took place, so physical evidence isn't really of any use to us there. So really the sole evidence that we're relying on is the memories and the testimony of the two parties involved. What you'll often find in cases like this is that when you have a case where memory is at issue, there will often be a memory expert, somebody like me or like my colleague Gillian or like Elizabeth Loftus, who might be called to testify about the nature of memory. And they'll be called to testify about how, you know, memory isn't just, you know, like I said, was talking earlier, that we don't just retrieve a memory fully formed, reconstructed, and we can incorporate misinformation into that memory. And that can be really, really helpful. And that has helped avert a lot of miscarriages of justice. But one thing that, so Gillian Murphy, who I work with in UCC, and I, one thing we had started to notice was that when you see that happening, when you see expert witnesses being called to talk about memory in these kinds of cases, it is almost every time the expert is called by the defense, or is called, you know, on behalf of essentially of the defense to kind of to bring the account of the complainant into question.
Yeah. So a woman is claiming that she's been assaulted,
yeah.
And the if, say, for example, the man in the question, who might be the aggressor, is then bringing someone like mm-hmm. you in to say, well, memories aren't very reliable.
Exactly. So now it's not always a woman, but we realize in reality, the vast majority of the time it is. And that, of course, there's a lot of gendered stuff that comes in there as well that makes things more complicated. But essentially, yes, if an expert is called, it's way more likely that they're going to talk about potential frailties in the complainant's memory. And they're not going to talk about the fact that the accused's memory might also be susceptible to distortion. And we thought, oh, that's interesting, because that sort of ends up giving the impression that the memory of the complainant is particularly vulnerable. And you'll hear a lot of different things that might make that person's memory vulnerable, like the passage of time, the kind of questions they might be at have been asked, whether they've been drinking alcohol on the night in question. All these things can make our memories more open to distortion. But the thing is that the complainant and the accused are both human. They're both subject to the same kinds of processes of memory distortion. And in theory, at least, they're both of their memories should be equally susceptible to these kinds of issues. But that's not what the impression that you would get if you were to look at this in a courtroom setting. And we said, well, you know, in a way, that's not surprising, because, you know, all of the evidence that has been built up around this comes through this field of eyewitness memory. And the goal of that was to avert miscarriages of justice, to prevent erroneous convictions where somebody would be convicted of crime based on a flawed eyewitness testimony. But it hasn't really accounted for the fact that sometimes you just have these cases where you have two people's memories who are at odds. And what it often ends up feeling like is as though it's the complainant who's on trial, that the complainant's memory gets kind of grilled to a degree that never happens with the accused, or it tends to be assumed that the memory of the accused is unflawed. A good example of this, actually, it's not an Irish example, but an example from the US. Your listeners probably remember the case of Christine Blasey Ford, who accused the Supreme Court Justice and Brett Kavanaugh of sexual assault. And you might remember during the hearings where he was being nominated to the Supreme Court, and there was a huge amount of discussion around this case. And in almost everything that you would read around it, there'd be a lot of discussion about the time that had passed since this event, how her memory of this event was probably flawed, how she had talked about this with a therapist, how she had talked about this with other people, and her memory was probably wrong. And this was kind of a huge amount of the debate in the media kind of went around. But actually, nobody really talked about the fact that, why are we assuming that his memory is unimpaired and her memory is impaired? So it was around this time that we started really thinking, can we actually try and experimentally investigate this? Can we see whether, is it the case that the complainant's memory is actually uniquely vulnerable, or is it that, actually there's an equal susceptibility to memory errors on both sides of that case?
So tell me about the study. What did you do and what did you find?
So what we did was we thought long and hard about, how can you actually really investigate this? You have to be quite careful. Obviously, you can't put people in a real world situation where they might, be experiencing some kind of assault for ethical reasons. So we decided to do what's the closest thing that we could do. So what we did was we recruited participants to a study where they would watch a video of a date, and the date is filmed from a first person perspective. and it's a video of either a man or a woman. So you are essentially the person behind the camera. And you're told, okay, you are going on a date and you get to choose which of these two people you want to go on a date with. So you can go on a date with Jessica or on a date with Samuel. Okay. And then you go on this date and it's all filmed from your perspective. And we see scenes of this date. And on the day, the two versions, the version with the male and the female actor are identical, except that it's a male actor or a female actor. Otherwise, they're absolutely identical. Just a shout out to my PhD student, Marianne, and her partner, Kyle, who are the actors in our videos. They did a fantastic job. What you do is you watch this video and you see scenes from this date where you see you meet Samuel or Jessica at the door of the pub, you chat to them, you go inside, you have a few drinks, they tell you some things about their past dating history. And then we have a scene when you're in the taxi and you're heading home and that they tell the taxi driver, you know, that you have two stops. And then at the end of the video, you have a little text screen that tells you, okay, at the end of the date, you both ended up going back to either Jessica or to Samuel's house and you had sex. And at this point, then we randomly assign participants to be in either the complainant condition or the accused condition. And if they're assigned to be the complainant, then they're told 2 days later, you went to police and you said that you did not consent to have sex with Samuel on this date and that you want to lodge a complaint of sexual assault. Or if you're put in the condition of the accused, then you're told 2 days later you are contacted by the police and they tell you that your date, so Jessica or Samuel, went to the police and told them that you had sexually assaulted them. Okay, and that you strenuously deny this. You say it didn't happen and they were a willing participant all along. So crucially, for ethical reasons, we don't actually show any sexual contact. We show the scenes of the date throughout prior to this. Okay, and because, of course, we have to be careful that we don't expose our participants unbeknownst to anything that might be kind of traumatic for them. Okay, so that's so far so good. You've gone on a date and now you've been told either you've accused somebody or that they have accused you. And then we say, all right, now you're going to read some witness statements from people who witnessed some part of your date. So we have witness statements from the bouncer who saw you meet each other at the door of the pub, from the barman who heard you, you know, have your conversation, and then from the taxi driver later on. Okay. And in those witness statements, there's some pieces of misinformation. What I mean by that is there are some details that are misleadingly described.
And they don't match the video that you'd watched.
Exactly. So in the video, for example, we see in the video that you arrive and your date, Samuel or Jessica, says, oh, hey, you know, you look just like your photos and I like your outfit. It's really cool. But then in our misleading description, we might say, oh, they described them as looking really sexy and said that their outfit looked like. So, you know, we'll kind of imply that they were doing things that were more sexually suggestive.
Yeah.
Or we might imply that they were, and, you know, they were plying the complainant with drinks, even though actually in the video they weren't. OK, so we're going to subtly alter the details.
Yeah.
Now, what we will find across the board in this study, in about a million previous studies, is what's called the misinformation effect, which is that when people remember that event later on, when they're asked later on to recall what happened during that date, they will incorporate some of that misinformation into their memory. Okay, so they will remember that their date said their outfit was sexy instead of saying it was cool. Or they'll remember that they bought them more drinks when they said they didn't. And subtle things. Or they might remember, you know, let's say you'd witnessed a car crash. And then later someone says, you know, how fast was the car going when it sped through the red light? And now later you remember there was a red light and that the car was going really fast when actually, you know, that's not what you originally witnessed. So your memory has now been distorted. This is just how memory works. It's really, really common. But what we wanted to know was whether that would differ depending on whether you were assigned to the complainant condition or the accused condition. What we found essentially is that no, that the complainant and the accused were equally susceptible to the misinformation effect. So their memories were distorted to exactly the same degree, regardless of which role they were assigned to. And in fact, we found that was the case even when the misinformation was designed so that it was specifically targeted at their role. So designed to kind of match up with the account of the accused or match up with the account of the complainant. Mm. Even then, we found that both sides were equally susceptible to that effect.
And what was the size of this study? Like, is it a reasonable number of people took part?
So it was across three experiments. So we had about 1,300 participants in total across three experiments, so about 400 and odd in each of the three experiments. It was, you know, we would conduct power analyses to make sure that we have enough participants that we really have the power to detect what we're looking for. Yeah. And we did, you know, so we're pretty confident in these results.
And so, Carol, what would that mean then for future cases, if you are being called up to the witness box, will that change how you testify in court, or does it give data to a prosecutor or a defense lawyer to say, well, look, this is, you know, this is evidence by a reputable scientist that shows it's two sides.
Yeah, and that is essentially what we're hoping for, that we're saying that expert witnesses should just be cognizant of this and be aware of this, that when they give that testimony, that you don't sort of unintentionally or intentionally give the impression that it's only one side of this case whose memory should be questioned. Now, of course, in reality, these things are not even Stevens. You know, people have a right, they're innocent, you're innocent until proven guilty. You know, there's a reason why you might have more evidence on one side than the other. But we really think it's important that when you're giving that sort of neutral expert testimony to a jury so that they understand and they can use that evidence and interpret it, that you're being very careful to show that actually that evidence will apply equally to both sides, that we need to treat memory like the way we treat any other kind of evidence, that it's a valuable form of evidence, but it can be contaminated. And we need to think about how it's collected, and we need to think about how we interpret that evidence. So just the same way as if somebody is reporting on blood evidence, you'd want to know how that evidence was collected. How was it stored? How was it treated? Was it contaminated by anything else? So we need to treat memory in the same way, that it's a valuable evidence, but it is open and subject to contamination.
It is horrific to look at the headlines and see how many women typically are the victim of a sexual crime and justice isn't delivered for them. Dr. Kira Green from the School of Psychology at UCD, thanks very much. If you have been affected by this discussion, the DRCC's helpline is 1800 77 88 88. Time now to look back at some of your comments from last week. We were speaking of Vaughan Steele, a researcher from Yale, who's in the middle of a study where he's using transcranial magnetic stimulation to try and help addicts cure themselves of their addiction. David says, have there been people completely cured by TMS? Not of addiction, David. And while there is some evidence to suggest it might be useful, really, this is quite an experimental technology, as you heard on the program. And we don't know a huge amount about how it works, but that it could work, which is what was really interesting about that piece last week. Sheila in Cork says, what are the side effects of TMS? It sounds like interesting research. So this thing has been around for a while. Transcranial magnetic stimulation is essentially using a magnetic coil to create an electrical current that is focused at a part of the brain. You're basically passing electrical current that very low and not dangerous, as far as we can know, to the brain to try and rewire some of the brain, which of course runs on electricity, as we heard from Vaughan Steele last week. The side effects, as we heard, were headaches. Sometimes people felt they got very hot, uncomfortable. Some people can get tinnitus. There isn't an enormous amount of long-lasting effects, but at the same time, I imagine it's quite an uncomfortable thing to be subjected to something quite experimental that's messing with your brain that you don't really know that much about. To be honest, it's not something I would be volunteering for, but you know, interesting research nonetheless. That's it from us on this week's episode. Hope you enjoyed the program. Thanks to Marais O'Sullivan, Rory Galvin, Hugo da Silva on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.